Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about Occupy Santa Fe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Donald Jackson. He is a world-renowned calligrapher, and he has inscribed and illuminated the St. John's Bible, which is on display at the New Mexico History Museum. The show is called Illuminating the Word, the St. John's Bible, and it's on display through April of next year, along with a show in the same space called Contemplative Landscape, about which we've already spoken a little bit on this program. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Nice to be here.
And Tom Leach is here. He's the director of the Palace Press at the New Mexico History Museum and has been deeply involved with this show. Welcome, Tom. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a huge project which you've been working on for how many years?
Well, 13 years in continuous work, one way or another, with a small team of selected artists, who each of which have contributed illuminations or illustrations, if you like, to the project. I suppose, really, it started earlier than that. I mean, it's always been a dream of mine.
To write out the entire Bible.
Yes. And then when it came to it, I realized I couldn't do it alone. So I had to, as it were, recruit a team. And it became a little bit like directing a movie. You know, you got skilled people to take certain parts. And I also acted as well as directed throughout it. But it took a long time to... from beginning to end. First of all, there was the idea, having to introduce the idea to what I thought were the ideal people. And this was, in fact, a Benedictine monastery, 60 miles, I want to say, north something, outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And it's also a university. And I'd been there various times over the years for calligraphic conferences and things like that. And I'd come to know them, and I thought, if anybody's going to do this, if anybody's going to ask me to do my lifetime's dream, it's going to be them, and I pitched it to them. And that was probably in 1995-96, and it took till another couple of years for it to come to a point where I could actually say I had the job, signed the contract, and then only delivered it this June.
So... this is a project you basically have on these huge vellum sheets written out in your calligraphy and illuminated, as you say, along with the team, the entire St. John's Bible. First of all, what is the St. John's Bible as opposed to any other Bible?
Well, they're a Roman Catholic community, but they wanted it to be as open to as many shades of the denomination as possible. So they chose a translation which is called the New Revised Standard Version, which is used in a lot of churches around the world. And it's actually so big, you mentioned size, it's seven volumes. It's been split into seven volumes. So you have the books of Moses, the five books of Moses, which is called the Pentateuch. That's one volume, and then it's broken up into another six. Finally, and the one I've just finished, which is the Book of Revelation, the letters in Revelation. So you have quite a big difference of subject matter as well. But to make it practical, they're in separate volumes, seven in all.
What are the historical precedents of a project like this?
Well, in modern times, it's not happened for at least 500 years, anything like this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tom Leach, you're making...
Well, it just, when you say historical precedents, I just feel, Donald, that there's just never been anything quite like this before on this scale.
You mean monks 500 years ago didn't use calligraphy and write out Bibles?
Well, I don't know about complete... Old and New Testament Bibles. There are gospel books, collections of parts of the Bible.
That's true, and then the Psalms and various other things. Mm-hmm. I mean, there have been, you know, why do it? This is the point. I mean, why do it after 500 years? Because now we can print them. the actual content of the Bible is available in its different slight variations in any bookstore or online, you know, countless things.
Right.
But what it struck me as, what started me really thinking about doing this, is that I saw a priest holding a volume of a book, a cheap printed book with a rather sort of ornate but nevertheless still cheap binding on it. And he held it up in this Abbey Church at St. John's and said, "This is the Word of God." And I looked at him and I thought, "You've got to be kidding. This doesn't look like any such thing. It doesn't look like it. It wouldn't be an experience of it. It may contain every word the same as one of the old Bibles of the past, but they had a magic. They contained something which made it the word special." And I thought that the sacred quality of it was, on many levels, missing.
And so you wanted to make a book that not only had the words, but showed that magic and illuminated it. Now, illuminating is both a metaphor and it's a specific term for a kind of illustration.
It is. It is actually the use of gold.
Yeah.
I mean, in very simple terms, it means to light up a page as you turn it. It isn't flat. I mean, it's a happening. In the most ideal situation, you sit and you hold a book and you enter it. I mean, in the worlds of now where we get everything on these little gadgets that people I see reading all the time, they're not books. But the same thing, you are entering into something. And what you bring is a frame of mind. A frame of mind is a context. And what we've created with this Bible is a context which puts you in a frame of mind, i.e. to open up to what's in there, what's in the Bible, in a special kind of way. Because visually, some of the main stories in it, some of the more uncommon stories in it, are actually illustrated and illuminated with the use of gold in a way which invites you to speculate upon the sacred, upon the divine.
What was your experience like? I mean, it's such a vast project, so many books, so many years, every single letter of every single word you were writing out by hand with quills and ink and in a perfect hand. I mean, I was watching a documentary about this, about your work, and I think, Tom, some version of that documentary will be available to be seen at the
Yeah, we
New
have
Mexico
it
History.
Playing outside of the gallery, and then we will probably show an extended version of it at some point.
I hope so, because it's a very well-produced documentary, and in this we get to see one thing that is not available in the exhibition, namely your hand forming these letters and the ink that is wet and filling in some of the big letters where the interior part has to be filled in with more ink or more paint, and then the making of these illuminations and the pressing of the gold leaf down onto the page and so on. I mean, this process, as you're doing it, are you thinking about and internalizing in some way the actual content of these stories as you're writing them?
Actually, the internalizing goes on long before that. You know, I tell you a little bit about the way it works. See, I'm not a knowledgeable person as far as religion is concerned, except I was brought up in a Christian tradition from a child and so on, so I share that. But I was advised by theologians at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota, and they selected certain passages that they wanted to be, I'll use the word illustrated or illuminated, in other words, interpreted in such a way that actually you're invited to ask yourself, what's going on here? What does, you know, you're actually drawn into the stories. So it would not have been done like this in the past. For instance, I mean, I was taking up my ideas from museums, yes. Artists always look around them and take, basically, I think artists are magpies. I mean, they steal all the time. anything that glitters, they steal it. So if it could be from a museum in a classical sense, but nowadays the internet. So I would say to my assistant, Sarah, I need skulls. I want to see severed heads. I want to see people hanging from a rope, because that's all, these are stories in the Bible. And so that, I want to see piles of bones, because, again, stories in the Bible that I'm asked to illustrate. So I could look at all of those things. But I'm also, in order to interpret an ancient stories, which are truths, which are literally human experiences, which are things that we've done, terrible things we do to each other, and in the name often of religion, by the way. And I try to spark your interest, because it's rooted in this moment. For instance, I'll give you two examples. I was illuminating a multiple story thing, which was five parables, all to do with the love of God. It was supposed to be saying, God loves you so much that you cannot imagine it. So you get this series of stories like the shepherd loses one sheep out of 100, and he leaves 99 and goes and looks for the one. Well, that is the most unthinkable thing for a shepherd to do. And he's talking literally to an agrarian community here. They know nobody would ever leave 99 to go look for a stupid lost one, because that doesn't make sense. And then you get the story of the prodigal son as one of those. Who would forgive somebody who spent all of their inheritance, ran off, ended up feeding pigs, which was about the worst thing a Jewish boy could do, and yet the father forgives? And at that point, when I was actually thinking of ideas for that, was actually doing it, two planes flew into the World Trade Center in New York. And into that illumination for the prodigal son, and I've always had a hard time with that story, because I always wanted to smack his face. That might be because I was the eldest son in my family, but it also, it's just annoying. I mean, and what you're reeling at is dealing with anger of somebody being so bad to you. And then that happened, and I realized that was the challenge here, to forgive the unforgivable. And at that point I realized that you were going to have to love your way out of this one. You couldn't hate your way out of it. And so that old story had an absolutely pin-sharp relevance to this present point in time.
And the idea that we have to love our way out of the so-called terrorist threat, as opposed to hate our way out of it, is a radically Christian idea that people have, I think, forgotten.
Well, basically the punchline is, it's got to be so hard that it's unimaginably hard, and that's what you're expected to do. But it's also saying that if you don't get it right, you're still going to be loved. I mean, that's the story. And on the other hand, if I may go on about the relevant, how can somebody living in this day and age, looking outside and watching automobiles go by, looking at a clear blue sky, sitting in a cafe, talking to you, be writing something that was written 2,000 years ago or three or whatever? And how does that make sense? Well, right up to the most freshest thing, the last thing I did, I was working on the book of Revelation, which has got really weird stuff. Multiple Hollywood images. I mean, it's Shazam, bang, lots of explosions, colored lights everywhere. And also there's this war in heaven. And a lot of people are familiar with this thing called the apocalypse, which means it's basically heaven in meltdown, these four horsemen bringing with them pestilence and plague and death and war, and people have nowhere to hide. They are literally crawling under rocks in the desert, trying to find a way to hide, and there is nowhere to hide. And at that point, we have a tsunami which sweeps away the guts of a nuclear power installation in Japan. Those people had nowhere to hide. They still, by the way, have nowhere to hide. And that's the perfect, it seemed to me, analogy of a modern day picture of absolute hopelessness, and we have to face that. Well, what do we do about that? And it's in the message.
And those kinds of images find their way into your illuminations, your illustrations?
Well, indeed, but only in a small way. I mean, you'll have to watch this space. But I did include, actually, I did mention this to the committee that at St. John's, and I felt that this was a nuclear parallel here, and they were quite supportive of that. So I said, well, when Satan falls to Earth, then I was thinking I'd have him land on an illustration of downtown Minneapolis, St. Paul. And they were a bit quiet about that. They said, there was a suggestion, couldn't you have him land somewhere else? But then I did say, I pointed out to them that just in between St. Paul and Collegeville, there is a nuclear power installation. We're talking 15, 20 miles away?
Yeah.
So I said, okay. So I had Satan fall on the nuclear power plant instead. But there is this little peaceful nuclear power plant, which I downloaded a picture of it from the internet. And in amongst all these lovely, innocent fields, but then all hell lets loose. But the main part is Satan falling to Earth with his... to continue the fight down here, which is part of the story of the Revelation. But it's not a big deal. I did put Minneapolis St. Paul in the far distance and then put it further away. But, I mean, it's relevant to me. That's how I make it. Because it has to make sense to me as an interpreter of it. And I'm coming at it, I don't have a heavy-duty theological background. I'm just a person who's living in this day and age, a product of his own culture, a sort of Anglo-Christian culture. But even I've got to be convinced. I'm not that brainwashed by anything, as far as I know, obviously. Successful brainwashing means I don't know. I wouldn't know about it. But I'm struggling to get to the punchline. Is it has to matter to me before I can help make it matter to you?
We're talking to calligrapher Donald Jackson about illuminating the word, the St. John's Bible, at the New Mexico History Museum. Tom Leach, could you talk a little bit more about the exhibition in terms, I mean, your thing is books, and we've had you on the air many times in the past, and the whole question of the context of this book. How have you done this exhibition?
Well, let me tell you how I came to this. I heard Donald speak at a conference in 2005, and it, you know, in a sense, it was a love at first sight when I heard about this project and saw this project, and I just felt this has to come to Santa Fe. Santa Fe and New Mexico is art, history, and religion, and that's what this book is art, history, and religion. And my position at the museum and the Palace Press is to be an advocate for the book. And I've just, as I said before, I've never seen a book like this, and it really is a masterpiece. And I wanted to share that with this community. So I won't say it was an uphill battle, but it took a long time to get it here. Just the usual exhibit planning takes a long time. And once it was coming together and into place, I wanted to give it another, more of a context, because the idea of just presenting this beautiful book with no explanation, it kind of goes against the grain of what we do at the History Museum, because we try to explain. We're a teaching institution, in a sense. And so this was an opportunity, because of the great support we get from St. John's University. Not only could we show the artwork, but we could show the process. We have lots of sketches, and we have Donald's tools and all these ancillary items that go into really telling the story of how this came about. And I think that's one of the strong points of the show, actually, because you see these fabulous pieces done with pens and knives and feathers and, you know, just things. I mean, honestly, I have drawers full of that stuff, but I can't do what Donald did. I also wanted to put this in the context of the history of the book. And so, you know, if you want to study the history of printing and books, Bibles are a great place to go, because they have been the one constant throughout history. I mean, there have always been people making Bibles in one way or another, whether by hand or by the printing press. And so I wanted to bring in the Gutenberg Bible, because that was really the start of a different understanding of what the book is. I mean, all of a sudden you have print, and that changed the world. Then books became very different from the way they were before Gutenberg. I think the beauty of this exhibit is we've come full circle, and now we have this book that has been very... What I'm speaking of is Donald's book, if I may call it that. We have a book that has been very much... print and all that print culture grew into, i.e. the Internet, you know, that's sort of the ultimate right now. That influenced Donald's book, but still everything that you see is done by hand. So yeah. I think it's a fabulous full circle. We show books or pages, illuminated pages before Gutenberg. We show Gutenberg's page. We show a first...
A real Gutenberg page?
A real Gutenberg page, yeah. And I still get thrills every time I see that piece. It's just an amazing thing. But we have a page of the first edition of the King James Bible. And then we show some, rather than real grandiose books, we show some simple little books within 50 years of Gutenberg's invention. You all already had the idea of the small, portable, personal book with Aldus Manutius's book. And that's the book that we still have today. That's what became the paperback.
Donald Jackson, so you have this massive project on huge pages, every single word done with your hand, putting the human energy of your being into these words of the Bible, and some of the pages are on display at the New Mexico History Museum. There have been and will be other showings of it, but then how is it to really be used as a whole book? In other words, do the Benedictine monks, are they the only people who get to see it? Are there reproductions? I mean, what happens to this object?
Well, interestingly enough, that's a great question, because this endeavor, which started off as one person's dream, just to do something that they wanted to do, because it was there, if you like, it's now taken on a life of its own. I mean, I and the other artists and scribes are finished. I mean, it's now taking off. I mean, it has continuously, each volume as it's been finished, have continuously been already on show in different museums. But having said that, I mean, what has been made from this, I'm actually now art directing a beautifully printed, illuminated, full-sized version of the St. John's Bible, which is still quite an expensive thing, but that is now being institutions all around the US and the different parts of the world are now buying these sets, and individuals too. So you can have a book which has now become, you know, has become a book on its... What am I trying to say?
It's a reproduction, but it's an object all of its
yes,
own.
Yes, that has become a beautiful leather binding and that sort of thing.
Is it full size?
Yes, absolutely. The same as near as we can get this. What I like to say is I'm trying to aim at the spirit, capturing the spirit of the original and putting as near as I can into the page. Now that's one version. But you can get off Amazon, for goodness sake, or better still, your local bookstore, you can buy each one, and I think the seventh volume, Book of Revelation, is available in January. So all of those are there, and they're coffee table size, and they're more reasonable, accessible price. But the actual... And there's a whole... believe me, I mean, the week before, I was in New York and being present at the presentation of a set of, so far, the ones that have been printed to the Pierpont Morgan Library in New York City. Now that, in my world, that's probably the finest place in the world you could be. I mean, they have three Gutenberg Bibles. The only place, apparently, they claim... in the world to have so much. And so that wasn't my engineering or anybody's. It's just arrived there now. I mean, and it's going out and into different places. And interestingly enough, the same week that the Pierpont Morgan Library had a set, a Baptist Bible College buys a set of Roman Catholic version of the Bible for use in their studies. So that I get a real kick out of that. It's spreading its own way, and the actual original will always be kept at St. John's, but it will parts of it will go out from time to time on exhibit. I'm bound to say that this exhibit in Santa Fe is really wonderful. I've been to see it for the very first time about 2 hours ago, and it's magical. They're beautifully presented, and also the accompanying photographs of landscape around perfectly fit together. But this probably to be one of the last times it's going to be on widespread public display for a number of time, for quite a while.
The exhibition is called Illuminating the Word, the St. John's Bible, and it's at the New Mexico History Museum through the 7th of April 2012, and the Contemplative Landscape Show is here also accompanying it through the end of the year. Donald Jackson, world-renowned calligrapher, will be speaking on Monday, the 7th of November at 6 o'clock at the Lenzic. People can buy tickets for that, and we will be able to not only hear more about this process, but actually see some of it too, and you'll present the way you do this and the swan feather quills and the whole thing. And so for tickets, people can call 988-1234. Tom Leach is director of the Palace Press at the New Mexico History Museum and has put all this together. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program Judith Lawson. She is a journalist. She is a member of the Occupy Santa Fe Media Working Group. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Occupy Santa Fe, along with Occupy Wall Street, Occupy every place else on planet Earth, it seems these days, is a movement that sprang up all over the place almost overnight. Here in Santa Fe, what happened? How did it begin? Where did it begin? Just give us, I mean, this is, we're documenting the history here of what may well turn out to be a very major movement.
It's moving so fast that forgive me if there are lapses in my knowledge of its history, because I came on board shortly after the first demonstration on the corner of the Paseo de Peralta and St. Francis. That was October 1st or 2nd?
Yeah.
So this Occupy Santa Fe...
Just a month. Yeah.
Just 1 month old. It's like a gangly colt. It's just got its legs under it, newborn. And it has come together with remarkable speed. The encampment, which is the physical manifestation of occupation that we have taken over, Santa Fe's beloved rail yard park, a beautiful park, a park many people treasure, a park with history and with ecological design built into it. And our encampment there is, on any given night, there are, I'd say, about 30 people sleeping in the probably 30-odd tents. We have a couple of guest tents. And a kitchen tent, a media tent, which just went up, which will be the hub of our communications. The donations have, from the generosity of Santa Feans, who are clearly ignited by this and thrilled, have been pouring in. We've opened accounts, both checking and savings, at Del Norte Credit Union.
As opposed to Bank of America.
As opposed to Bank of America or Wells Fargo or Citibank. And we are under the wing of a small nonprofit, so we do have 501c3 ability. And as I said, all kinds of donations have been pouring in, and we still need more because we're growing every day. Not exponentially yet, but pretty quickly.
What has been the kind of emotional or kind of motivational sense of the people who are down there occupying and who are supporting the group that's occupying?
Well, I'll backtrack just a little bit. There are, I'd call them a group, a core group of, now they really are facilitators, and they have all been to New York to occupy Wall Street.
Okay.
they're tremendously important because they hold the lineage. They call them the lineage holders. We have also had the privilege of having Ken Mayers of Veterans for Peace, who's occupying in Washington right now, has been to Wall Street, and has been with Occupy Santa Fe at our rallies at the Roundhouse. And guidance from a couple of other people who is invaluable because they have the experience. Now, we are gaining hand over fist lots and lots of younger people who know that everything is wrong. Not just something is wrong, but everything is wrong. They can't find work. They are homeless. They are without resources. They have come out of the many kinds of abusive situations that young people are in our culture today. So we welcome them. We also have been welcoming. We have a huge learning process going on with a very large homeless population of Santa Fe. Every Occupy site has been welcoming homeless people. We must walk a very careful line because of alcoholism and drug use.
Right.
We have a clear agreement with the police that we won't tolerate anyone using drugs or alcohol on our site. And we have been kind, I'd say with great kindness, I have seen, especially the men, some of whom have been in the military, enforcing that. And I heard the other night that the police are very happy because Rail Yard Park is much calmer and quieter since Occupy has come to
Isn't
set its
roof. Interesting.
Down. Isn't that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I find so fascinating about this movement in its manifestations all over the country, which seems so similar in each place, is that there is such a desire for, I mean, there have been these terrible incidents, like in Oakland, this young man getting his head shattered or really badly injured. But there's been basically a kind of atmosphere of let's work with the police, let's work with the city, let's work with each other. Let's not develop an us against them attitude because it's all us or it's 99%. Yeah.
We are the 99%. And that is a very unifying expression of what this movement, this is becoming a movement. And as you've said, it's all across the country and all around the world now. We don't know much about what's happening in Asia, but certainly in Europe.
Yeah.
So there is a growing solidarity linked by the internet and all the social media, a great deal of communication. We've had people come in, visit and stay with Occupy Santa Fe in just this one week from Taos, from Española, from Albuquerque, from Oakland, from Austin. So Santa Fe being Santa Fe, and as the young occupier who I hoped would be with me today, Alex Delgado, has very eloquently put it, Santa Fe is geographically the highest capital in the country, and seen through the lens of its artistic and creative fame and population, it's also the highest in the country. So it's nice to have that sense of there's kind of a roiling, let's express ourselves through the arts and let's create this and that, combined with the multitude of all of us who are, let's say, over 25, I don't know. I mean, these are arbitrary numbers. Age has very little to do with this. But there are a lot of older folks who have some experience with the biggest protests in our recent history, Vietnam, civil rights movement. And also social workers who are extremely familiar with the challenges of the homeless in Santa Fe. The fact that there are between 1,200 and 1,500 homeless people in Santa Fe is, we think, enormously important. We would like to see an outpouring of what's needed, which is certainly a great deal of financial contribution to probably another shelter, more staff. The need is urgent and very great.
It's been said that the Occupy movements are creating microcosms of the society they'd like to have. And so you've got this kind of ethos of fairness and justice and food and sharing.
Compassion
and
above all.
And mm-hmm. compassion above all in this small scale, which is what you'd like to spread out. And I was looking at the Occupy Santa Fe Facebook site, and there was a quotation from a speech that somebody in one of the Occupy movements had given, and it said, I'm going to read this. It said, the World Health Organization lists six qualities that define a psychopath. One, callous unconcern for the feelings of others. Two, an ability to have enduring relationships. Three, reckless disregard for the safety of others. Four, deceitfulness, repeated lying and conning for profit. Five, inability to experience guilt. And six, failure to conform to social norms with respect to lawful behavior. And then the person makes the point that the CEOs are the heads of corporations that embody psychopathic personhood. And I read that. I thought, you know, there we have it.
There we have it. Now that was a speech. Now, given this is the human mic technique of speech making by Elizabeth Christine, who is the founder of the Transition Towns movement, a kind of umbrella in Santa Fe. And she then wrote an article off of that, which is on the front of the Broadside, the two-page newspaper of which I am editor, the New Mexico Broadside. But it could hardly be said more succinctly and vividly. There was a film, I think it might have been made 8 or 10 years ago, called The Corporation, in which Harvard Medical School psychiatrists and psychologists evaluated the corporation, and these are the characteristics that they saw, that they found. So there we have it. A corporation in our time is a psychopathic entity.
And it doesn't have to be that way.
No, that's not what they were in the beginning.
I think that it's important, I mean, when making distinctions about what's wrong and what's right, to really delve into those distinctions. I mean, what's wrong is that psychopathic attitude, and in many ways that goes back to what is necessitated by an infinite growth model. And we talk about this over and over in terms of economies and ecosystems, you know, how it's not natural within ecosystems to have infinite growth, but somehow in economies we expect this. Yeah. But I think it's also important to talk about how it is possible to have corporations providing all sorts of wonderful things that we need. I mean, look at what you're wearing. Look at what I'm wearing. Look at what's on our feet. Look at, you know, look at what vitamins we took just this morning. The mixer that is in front of me here, the headphones that we have on, every single one of these made by a corporation and shipped in a truck to Santa Fe somehow or other. And to think about and really discuss very seriously how those things could be done in a way that is fair and just.
Well, you probably know, and I believe it was Tom Hartman who just last week identified, I saw him on a program where he had gotten his hands on a book that has the closest real history of how corporations came to be what they are today. It began in the 1820s, and there were sort of backroom decisions made by the Supreme Court, which was nothing like the court of today, and then culminating in the Citizens United decision. But corporate personhood has been growing like an evil fungus. It's Halloween, so I can talk that way, you know, an evil fungus. And it's a system. What you can see when you pull back and use your long lens is that this is a system that has increasingly required the people who are its managers, its executives, its employees, and I think something like 100 million Americans work for corporations. That's a lot of us. That's a third of us. The requirement is that you become part of a corporate culture, and the corporate culture has become increasingly rapacious because you can't satisfy the appetite of endless growth and profits and ever higher profits for shareholders. Boards of directors and primary shareholders are a very small number of people. That's what the 1% really is.
We're talking to Judith Lawson of Occupy Santa Fe. So let's go back to Santa Fe. What is the camp like? Are you using solar power? I saw a call for bikes to have bicycle-generated electricity, things like that. What does it look like?
Well, as of last night, we'd had two generators donated, the use of those, because we have to use a generator for just a few things until our solar installation goes in. I think it's Randy, I'll say his name wrong, but a positive energy, Randy Sedgwick, I think, one of the solar guys who's been around for a long time. He's donating all the components. We're looking for someone who will donate the batteries. We need a bank of, it's either 4 or 6, deep charge batteries, golf cart batteries, basically. And then we're set, because we don't need much. We need a couple of lights for the kitchen. And for our media center, we need to be able to run maybe 2-3 laptops at a time and a couple of lights. It's really not much. So a solar panel's perfect.
Do you plan to stay all through the winter?
As far as I can tell, Mary Charlotte, we are here in Rail Yard Park for the duration, indefinitely.
It's so interesting to me to observe this, because for years I have been watching people, listening to them, interviewing them about their concerns, dissatisfactions, and fears with this society that we live in. And above all, certainly from my point of view, not only the economic, but the environmental concerns. I mean, you know, making your planet uninhabitable for human life and a whole lot of other life is no joke, and it's not something to be politicized or taken as something we can deal with 10 years from now or 20 years from now or something like that. And everybody's worried about it, and nobody has known what to do, and everybody's talking about, well, I'm signing petitions and I'm writing letters and all this. And suddenly these Occupy movements are springing up everywhere. And the metaphor from nature that comes to mind about that is crystallization.
Yes.
So you have all these molecules floating around, and suddenly they coalesce into a crystal very rapidly. And that crystal has a structure, and that structure is consistent throughout.
Another beautiful metaphor is the caterpillar cocoon to butterfly. In the cocoon phase, which is terribly ugly, and there's nothing much in there but mush, as far as we know, there is something called the imaginal buds of the new life that is the butterfly. There are many, many examples in nature of just what we're talking about. And I totally agree with you that this is what we're seeing and feeling and experiencing on every level. It's just, whoo, all coming together and blooming. Timing must be right, and we have, you know, we're humans. We don't really have any say over the timing of things.
Yeah, and at this moment, for whatever reason it happened, one of the things which we talked about yesterday with Merle Lefkoff, because we talked about Occupy Wall Street, is the importance of this movement becoming staying nonviolent.
Yeah.
Is that a challenge? That seems to be just one of the basics that everybody is adhering to?
It's a challenge in a way that I hadn't anticipated, and this is how it looks. To be nonviolent is a discipline. It's a cultivated discipline, because we are all coming from a violent culture where the language is violent, the images are violent. We're surrounded by a lot of forms of violence. Santa Fe's been fortunate to have Marshall Rosenberg come and teach nonviolent communication at least 2 or 3 times. And there are people here who are well-versed and practiced. It's more than communication. There are so many people coming into camp who something in them has just given way, and they have to vomit up their anger, their angst, their pain, their fear. And we're beginning to understand how we have to make a place for that. Just as in certain indigenous traditions, you dig a hole in Mother Earth and you vomit your stuff into that hole and cover it up and ask the earth to heal it and take it. So we're working with that. We have a lot of very skilled people amongst us who have great understanding of things like co-counseling, you know, simple
right,
ways.
Right. So instead of putting a bowling ball through a bank window.
Yeah.
you work with it internally.
Internally.
Which is also a kind of a sign of the maturity of this movement compared to, say, what was happening 30 years ago.
Yeah. Although I did read that in San Francisco, some guy in the Occupy San Francisco movement stood up and he was, you know, probably stoned and drunk and said, "We're just having a party. This is just about a party."
Yeah, well, that's San Francisco.
That's San Francisco. But Occupy Santa Fe is not about having a party. It's about we're beginning to understand a mission here.
How do you, so far, and again, you know, talking about the gradual emergence of this movement and not trying to force it any faster than it is and so on, but how do you understand that mission so far?
Well, the mission so far, again, we only need 50 feet of light on the path ahead of us. We really can't see that far ahead. But learning how, we'll call it consensus democracy. It's 9/10 consensus. We're following the Wall Street model, which has evolved too. But this kind of whole self participatory democracy, which where you're present rather than being represented, it's very experimental. We haven't ever done this in the U.S. before as a people, and we are experimenting with it. So that, I'd say, is the first phase. And then we begin. Now we have working groups that have broken out. I believe Occupy Santa Fe has almost 20 working groups. Things such as inclusiveness, tremendously important in our multi-ethnic, multi-racial town. And ideas and possible, you know, people really reading and going deep into the current literature, not so much the past literature, because this is something different.
Yeah.
So within the working groups, proposals come forward, and then they're presented to the General Assembly. And if they're not wholly acceptable, after a lot of discussion usually, then they have to go back to the drawing board and come back with it or not come back with it. So it's an evolving process that it feels like it's always in motion. It feels like we're swimming in a lot of water here in the desert.
Ultimately, there will have to be a movement that has the result of a much, much, much stronger environmental protection than what we have so far, and basically people and biological life on Earth centered rather than profit centered. Not that the two are absolutely mutually exclusive, mind you, if we have a clean energy economy, that's an economy and so on, but basically that has to be life centered, and that's a big job.
Life centered. The economy that we have, and mind you, it's a broken economy. Some time ago, the financial economy split from the Main Street economy. That was very easy to see, I thought, maybe 2-3 years ago. And we are coming to the place where that is not sustainable at all. I mean, finance, its relationship to economy. Economy comes from an old Greek word, which means household affairs.
Right, right.
And I'm going to go back for a moment to our friend Charles Eisenstein, who is, even though he doesn't live here, he's come to Santa Fe many times, and his new book, Sacred Economics, speaks directly to what we all really want. We want a good and decent life. We want a good and decent life for all the others. And the honoring of all sentient forms of life. I'm speaking as a Buddhist with a small b, but this is the truth.
Right.
This is what we want in our hearts. And right there in Occupy Camp, in our campsite, I ask anyone to come and visit us, please, and you'll feel the beating heart of the movement there.
Judith Lawson is a journalist. She's a member of the Occupy Santa Fe Media Working Group, and Occupy Santa Fe is on the web at
OccupySantaFeNM.org.
Judith, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at Facebook.com/RadioCafe, and my email address is radiocafe@KSFR.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.